This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk.
Hi, my name's Chris Scott and I'm here with Mary Bridges. How are you, Mary?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you.
You are the winemaker here at Gusbourne in Kent, the wine garden of England. But people often think of Kent as being the sort of fruit bowl of the UK.
Yeah, I think typically it was. Everything ripened here nicely.
Yeah, all the hops, everything like that. And weather's supposed to be, the weather's supposed to be the best in England anyway. Do you agree?
I agree. I think we have it nice here. And this year particularly, we've been spoiled by the weather.
But you are from Inverness, so what you're thinking is nice weather is not the same as everybody else.
Yeah, for sure. The bar was raised moving to England.
Excellent. What we want to talk about today is we're going to talk about yeast. You said that this is your thing that you're into, cultured yeast.
So I love making sparkling wine. You can't get away from yeast. It's there in the primary fermentation and it's there in the second fermentation. You know, it's my world. And I particularly love tirage and bottling for second fermentation, because on the lead up to that and during that, we make loads of yeast cultures. So essentially the yeast that you add to the wine with the sugar to gain that pressure and that little bit extra alcohol during second fermentation. They take a lot of looking after. So we start with a commercial dried yeast. And the first step there is the rehydration. And you've got that's the very first bit that's so easy to get wrong and can impact the health of your culture and cause you all sorts of problems. So being really respectful and doing that right is so important, but it's the next phase. You're then adding that yeast to something that it really doesn't want to be added to. You're adding it to wine with a low pH and that's got alcohol in it. It likes very specific temperatures. So as a winemaker, you're responsible for acclimatizing this yeast that's all of a sudden being thrown into this environment that it hates and treating it in such a way that when you add it to the bottle, you know that it will thrive. And that's an even worse environment. You know, you're sealing off the oxygen, there's pressure gaining. It's really a horrible place to be. So you've got to make sure that those yeast are robust and healthy. And we'll see that second fermentation through all the way to dryness. And they really respond to what you do. So I love it. I love looking after the yeast and making sure that they're happy and healthy.
My understanding about yeast, and I'm obviously pretty ignorant, but yeast is an organism that adapts quite well to its conditions if it's given time. So I've spoken to winemakers in the past who've said, you know, one way to remove yeast from a wine is to chill it down and filter it out. And he was saying, you know, this is years ago, that if you chill the wine slowly, it doesn't kill the yeast. Whereas if you suddenly chill it, it'll kill the yeast, which if you're trying to stop the fermentation, killing the yeast is a good idea.
Yeah.
And so if you do something, a sudden change, it doesn't adapt very well. Whereas if the change is more gradual, it can adapt. So when during fermentation, the alcohol's coming up, each generation of yeast that's being split is getting born into this high alcohol environment. But you're taking a product that's in a water medium, effectively, and then you're adding it to a high alcohol, low pH environment. So it's quite a shock.
Yeah, and the pH can be really low. In some harvests, it can be sub-3, so 2.9 to 3, which is kind of on the limits, I would say.
Just for the listeners, pH is measure acidity. 7 is neither acid or alkaline. And low numbers is the lower the number, the more acidic.
Yeah. So wine is a pretty low pH product. And yeast, they don't love that. And at the same time, you're throwing them into somewhere where there's alcohol. So base wines for us were typically around 10.9%, which again isn't super high.
No.
But combined with the low pH, these things don't work in isolation, they work synergistically. So the more of these limiting factors you have in the mix, the worse it is for the yeast. So when you're rehydrating them, I like to do it in just water and water at the right temperature, sort of 35 degrees, because you want the yeast to kind of, they're all like, they're scrunched up when they're dried. And when they rehydrate, you want them to rehydrate nice and round. So there are no holes or no indents in their membrane, because that's where you've got a weak spot, and that's where the yeast is always sort of regulating its own internal pH. And if you have a hole for this toxic to the yeast, the wine is toxic coming in, that's when you'll have cell death and they won't reproduce, and you won't have those generations in bottle that will finish off the fermentation. So making sure that you rehydrate them correctly is super important.
How do you do that? Do you just warm temperature, sprinkle them on? And
yeah, so I have filtered water, so you've got no kind of dry residue or that sort of thing in the water. So filter the water, get it around 35 degrees, put the yeast in. I give it a little mix, and then you leave it for a certain amount of minutes, maybe 15 minutes, give it a little stir again. And a real key step is you're then going to add that to a wine, sugar, water mix. So it's not quite as toxic as just pure wine at that stage, because it's slightly diluted with the water. You want to make sure that the temperature of your bucket of rehydrated yeast and the temperature of your mix that you're going to add it to is the same, because that's when you'll have a thermal shock. And that's exactly what you said. Yeast don't like being shocked, and they might not die, but you might give them such a shock that they shut down for a time, and then they don't kind of develop and grow and reproduce as they should. So you make sure that temperature is correct, and we hold things around 20 degrees. That seems to be a sweet spot for our cultures. So there's a little bit of nutrient that we add to that as well. So it's sterols, amino acids, that sort of thing, which helps the cells to resist some of these toxic factors that they don't like. And we call that the baby culture at that stage. So that takes about 24 hours, and we're measuring the specific gravity, which is essentially the density. As that drops, that's an indicator that the yeast are consuming the sugar, which is what you want them to do, because they consume the sugar so that they can grow. And once they've kind of depleted a certain amount of that, you want to then introduce that to a larger volume of wine, sugar, and water so that it can continue to acclimatize again. That's about a day and a half that we have the acclimatization. So the goal is you've got this mix of yeast, and that you want it to be at around 24 grams per liter of sugar when it's ready, because you're about to add it to a tank of wine that you've added 24 grams per liter of sugar to get your pressure increase.
Yep.
And you want them to be about the same, so there's no osmotic stress, that kind of thing. And again, you want to make sure they're the same temperature. So you're always looking out for the yeast. You're always making sure they're in a place they want to be. They're not shocked, they're not stressed. You give them a bit of oxygen, and we look over the top of the tanks, and it's lovely when you go in and it's rolling. You know, you can physically see the liquid moving on its own. And that's just the fermentation sort of taking off, and you know that you've got a good culture on the go. And we'll always do a cell count as well before we add any of this yeast to the wine. We'll make sure that we've got sufficient cells, that they look really healthy under the microscope, that they're budding, which is really important. You don't just want a lot of mature cells. You
What's
want
budding?
Them. Budding is when you can see the mother cell and you can see a little daughter cell just about to detach from it. So you know that they're actually reproducing. They're not just kind of in there and not doing anything else. So that's fun. I love counting the yeast, and I mean, it's all very nerdy stuff, but I love it. And we've recently employed a new lab manager, so she is about to enter a whole world of yeast counting in the next couple of weeks when we start bottling.
Okay. The other thing that yeast doesn't like is sugar. Sugar is like salt to a yeast, mm-hmm. where it draws moisture. If you've got high enough sugar level, it draws moisture through the membrane and basically dries out the yeast and kills it off as well, just like salt does. That's why you preserve things in salt, because it kills off bacteria and yeast cells and all those sort of things. So it is a really toxic environment for yeast, isn't
mm-hmm.
it?
It's all the things they don't like all at once.
Yeah, yeah. Do you find you get many bottles that just don't take?
No, so we don't, if you...
That's not your still red wine you're flogging, is it?
If you have the correct, and more cells isn't necessarily better, you want the right amount of cells, because if you have too many, then the biomass is bigger, and then you might run into riddling issues further down the line if your adjuvant addition isn't sufficient to cope with the biomass that you put in the bottle. So more cells isn't necessarily better, because if they're unhealthy, they're still going to run into the same problem and not the generations aren't going to continue in bottle. So you want the right number of healthy cells. So we will check the mother culture before we add it. And then once we've added it to the tank that we're about to bottle, we'll then do another cell count on that tank. We'll check the sugar. We'll check the density. So you make sure all the factors are right before we even send it through the bottling line. And if we are not happy with anything, we just won't. You know, once that wine is in bottle with the crown cap on, you can't do anything. It's in there. So you need to make sure that before you put it in there, you are 100% happy. You need to make sure you've checked the SO2 on the wine that you're about to add it to. Anything. I don't really like going above 8-3. The lower the better. Because that, you know, you add SO2 to stop yeast.
Kill things, yeah.
Which is something that's in the wine because we use it to keep the wine safe, sort of through blending, filtering, and that sort of thing.
Just for the listeners, SO2, when we're talking about free SO2 can bind to oxygen. It's not, and once it's bound to oxygen, we sort of call it bound SO2. And if you want it to do something, you need to make sure that you've got free SO2. You monitor the levels of free SO2. So just because it's a little bit geeky, I thought.
Oh, I know. I often find myself talking to people and they look at me like, you've given me no context here. You're just talking about just talking numbers at me. So yeah, we'll make sure the SO2 level is low enough that we're not going to have any problems. And we have a laser ephrometer in the lab as well now. So it's a non-destructive way of measuring pressure. So traditionally you have to put the needle through and you read the gauge. But we can now, the crown cap can be on and it takes the temperature and can read the gases in the headspace in the bottle. We can actually measure every 10 days we do it after we've bottled, you can see the pressure increasing. And after about 50 or 60 days, you generally get your stable reading at maximum pressure. And then what we'll do at that stage is we will open that bottle. And the great thing about it being non-destructive is you're checking that same bottle every time. So it's the same fermentation. Bottle variation doesn't, you're not accounting for bottle variation. Once we get to the end of that 50 or 60 days, we open that and then run the analysis on it. So we'll check the residual sugar and you'll see a nice correlation of something with sort of 1 gram per liter or less and a pressure of sort of six and a half bar. And you know that it's finished fermenting. At that point, you can kind of relax. You know you've done your job and you know that you've got this lovely dry and wine with some bubbles, which is the whole point of what we're trying to do. It's extremely technical. There are loads of ways things can go wrong and you just have to be, you have to be thorough. You have to have attention to detail and you've really got to have a good understanding of what is the implication. If I accidentally leave the cooling on at 15 degrees for the yeast overnight, which I wouldn't do. You know, if you did, you need to know, well, that's probably not going to be viable now. I've got to start again. And you need to understand the implications of when a factor goes too far that you can't do anything to sort of bring it back. So
one of the things I thought was interesting, and it's not interesting in the slightest, but in my mind, I always think you fill the bottle up, and then you put some yeast and sugar and a dosage. We call it the dosage. You get a bottle, you put the dosage in, put the crown cap on, and you're away. But you didn't say that. You said you have your holding tank, you put the dosage into the holding tank. I presume it gets mixed in pretty quickly. And then you bottle from it, which is not the way I always think about it. Is that taught wrong? Or is it just that this is the way you guys do it? Or what's the story?
I think because we have two different things. We have the tirage liqueur and the dosage liqueur. And I think we talk a lot about dosage liqueur, which is the final step in winemaking. So it's after lees aging. You've riddled the bottle. You've disgorged it. So you've got the lees have been removed. And then the last thing you're adding is the dosage. So that's your final opportunity to tweak the sweetness level of the wine. So that's the dosage. And that is... it goes through a line and every individual bottle gets a little a little bit of this liqueur. Whereas the tirage liqueur, so it's completely homogeneous and every bottle is getting the same, we'll add the sugar to that the day before and keep it mixing. So it's got all night to fully dissolve and be fully homogeneous. And then when we add the yeast culture in the morning of bottling, once we're sure the culture is really healthy, again, we have it mixing the whole time. And we'll do cell counts as we're bottling as well. So from the full tank, half tank, bottom of tank, just to make sure that everything's the same. And it's just a more reliable way. And it's pretty standard practice for anyone bottling traditional method is to have it in a tank and bottle it through like that.
Okay. The other culture that's used in wine, and particularly in English wines, is lactic acid bacteria, or we'd call it maybe malolactic conversion. Some older style people might call it malolactic fermentation, but it's not a fermentation.
It's a decarboxylation.
Is that what it is? Yeah. Okay. Oh, please, I've got that. We're going to do a little bit more on malolactic conversion and malo acid in the vineyard. But do you want to just tell us a little bit about how you manage or don't manage malolactic conversion inside the winery?
Yeah, so we do malolactic fermentation on the base wines. And
all wines undergo full malo?
Typically the cuvée does or did. So the cuvée for us is the first 51% of the pressing. And then we take two pressings after that, so another 6% and another 10% at slightly. Tie one and tie two is what we call them. So the tie component, we block mallow on because they end up these lovely, they're not the bones of the blend, but they're nice to add in small percentages. They're a high acid, zippy, tangy, lovely component that's quite textural too. So they just add a little bit to the blend when we're tweaking them at the end. Whereas the cuvée, which is the bones of the blend, traditionally we've kind of had 100% malolactic. Acids are falling in the UK as the climate is warming in the UK. And the kind of first time my eyes were really open to it was in 2023. And we didn't have a particularly warm or hot, sunny season in 2023. But sort of as the grapes were ripening, the nights were kind of warm as well. So usually in a region where you've got a high diurnal shift, the respiration, which is what is degrading the malic in the vines, happens during the day, but kind of shuts down overnight as the temperature cools. When you have warm nights, that mechanism in the vine is still kind of working. So you're getting faster malic degradation, which means the malic acid in the juice in the wine is going to be lower. So in 2023, they were quite low. So what we did was we blocked malolactic fermentation on a few of the cuvée tanks as well, just so that when we're blending, we've still got that lovely balance that we're known for. And the malic acid, as long as it's not kind of the dominant acid in the wine, adds that elegance and adds that freshness without kind of being tart and green and sort of overly austere. So in a couple of vintages, we have played around with blocking a little bit and blocking total tanks rather than starting the malolactic fermentation, letting it go halfway and stopping it.
Once it starts, you can't stop it.
Yeah, and I find if you try and stop it, and we would stop it by chilling it and adding SO2, if you try and stop it as it's going, you can lock in some funky aromas as well, because I think as you stop them, they release all these kind of stress aromas.
Oh, okay. Like yeast releases VA, volatile acidity, when it's under stress.
A similar thing, yeah. If you stress them, they'll get you for it. So if we know it's going to be a year where we're doing partial malolactic, we'll choose some tanks that will go 100% and some tanks that we just won't. We'll block it from the get-go.
Yeah, okay. And is SO2 good at stopping it? Lactic acid bacteria is sensitive to SO2. But people often go about yeast being sensitive to SO2 as well. But you need a heck of a lot of SO2 to stop yeast from fermenting. Is it much less SO2?
So because our pH is generally pretty low, less SO2 goes further. So it's quite effective. And with lactic acid bacteria, I find them even more sensitive to SO2. So at a low pH, it doesn't take a lot to inhibit them. And then you put the cooling on at the same time. So you've kind of got two factors stopping it. And it doesn't stop immediately. So that's why if you were starting a tank and you were going to try and stop it halfway through, you might think you've stopped it at 2 grams left. But actually, by the time it's taken effect, you might have, you know, dropped another gram because it doesn't take effect immediately. But if you haven't started, I find it much easier to add the SO2, chill the tank. We keep everything on the gross fermentation lees as well where possible. And we don't have any problems with malolactic starting up, you know, once we've stopped it. It seems a pretty safe way of holding the wines.
When you're normally learning about winemaking, you think alcoholic fermentation finishes, malolactic goes next. I was talking to Hattingley Vineyards a couple of years ago, and they were saying that sometimes the malolactic's occurring during the alcoholic fermentation. It's not like as clean as you might want to believe. It just does it when it gets going. Does that mean you have to chill and manage SO2 during fermentation rather than afterwards? Or
we don't rely on spontaneous malolactic. We'll always inoculate for it. And we, because our pH is so low, we don't use direct inoculation. We'll build up a culture, similar in the way that we do for the yeast for the tirage, over a number of days. So we will add that at the tail end of fermentation. So it's kind of a mix between a sequential and a co-inoculation, I guess. Because if you add it when there's still some temperature from the fermentation, it starts and takes much quicker. I like to have malolactic finished early where possible. I like to, the fermentation to be quick and clean and the malolactic to be quick and clean. And then add the SO2, have the chilling on so that the wines have longer to rest on their lees before we start grading and blending, because I think we make much better decisions about the wines when they've had time to sort of chill out and relax after they've been through all these processes.
Yeah. It's like bottle shock, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And it's interesting. So when you're around them every day, you taste them at various stages during their fermentation and malolactic. And some days you like it and the next day you think, oh, I don't like it so much. And then it comes around and you like it. You know, you can taste too often and kind of see a wine go through all of its stages. So I think getting these processes done quickly and clean, we make better decisions when we're blending. We've given the wines a bit more time on those gross lees. So actually managing the SO2 regime is really easy. If they're going to be something we inoculate, then that's fine. They're generally still in fermentation when we inoculate. If we know we're not going to inoculate it, once the fermentation finishes, we will knock it on the head with some SO2 so that malolactic doesn't start at all. When malolactic is finished, so we're monitoring, we do a weekly check and monitor the drop. When it's finished, we'll maybe leave it for another week or so before we add the SO2, again, just to give the opportunity for it to completely peter out, so we're not locking in any aromas that we don't want to. And there are, I think, depending on the bacteria strain that you're using, there are other things that happen as well. So for diacetyl production, I think citric acid metabolism by the bacteria happens after malic acid metabolism. So if you want to really enhance your diacetyl,
it's your butter flavors,
you leave it longer before you add the SO2. We're not chasing a lot of diacetyl, but if you are, that, you know, if you don't SO2 straight away, you have more development and more locking in of those positive flavors.
I thought also some of the buttery flavors people get from malolactic, because you don't see you don't see diacetyl or buttery flavors in a lot of wines, and I thought part of that was also to do with the bacteria strain that you choose. Some lactic acid bacteria can produce lots of this diacetyl, yeah, buttery flavors, and some strains don't produce much at all. Are you saying it's two parts? It's the selection of strain and also leaving the wine on the malolactic, on the lactic acid bacteria deadness. I don't know. What's the word for lees for lactic acid bacteria? I don't know what it is.
Yeah, I think it is a bit of both. There certainly are citric negative strains, so you could leave it forever and you wouldn't get any diacetyl.
So it's when the lactic acid bacteria processes citric acid,
yeah,
that it converts it into diacetyl.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, I did not know that. I'm learning so much about lactic acid. And one thing I'd like to know, in the UK as well, is what percentage of malic acid is, compared to tartaric acid is there in the final wines or before you go through malolactic conversion?
So when we pick, we do a malic, when we're checking our acids and sugars, we do a malic split. So if we were picking Chardonnay, for example, at 14 grams per litre total, we could expect 6 or 7 of that in a coolish year to be malic. In a warmer year, you might have less, but then it would kind of drop the level that you were picking it at. So it can be getting on for 50% at that stage.
Yeah.
And then when we go through malolactic, it depends on the malic in there that will determine how much lactic you have. And it's roughly, if you had 3 grams of malic, that might convert and you'd have 1.5 of lactic. So it's kind of half.
Does it mean that the acidity's halved? Because that doesn't necessarily, like malic acid might have a different pH to lactic acid.
No, it doesn't really halve. So I would say in a finished wine, we sit between 7.5 and 9.5 grams TA. So from 13, 14 grams at picking to finished wine, it's actually quite a drop. But some of that, you get some crash out during fermentation and some drop out with tartrates and that sort of thing. You get the loss during malolactic fermentation. I'm old school and I keep calling it a fermentation, yeah. even though I know what it is.
Conversion. It's malolactic conversion.
I'm going to start calling it decarboxylation. I'll throw everyone off. And then if you do cold stabilization as well, which we do, you lose a little bit again. Of tartaric. So you don't get the malic dropout at that point. And then we don't deacidify base wines. We rely on the drop during fermentation and the malolactic. So we pick it at a level that we can kind of reliably know that we'll get to 7.5 to 9.5. But that depends on the season.
Okay. And I just want to confirm, I've had one winemaker tell me this. I just want another one to tell me this. Your tartaric acid doesn't typically change depending on the climate and the growing season. So whatever tartaric acid you've got is a function probably more of the grape variety than of anything else, is it?
Yeah, and I can't remember there's a precursor for tartaric acid, something that synthesizes it or whatever in the grape. I think at Veraison, the content of tartaric you have is fixed. The concentration might change if you get dilution.
Or Veraison, the berries will swell, so you'll get dilution.
So you'll get, the content won't change, but the concentration will. Malic acid is different in that the content and the concentration can change because malic can be diluted, but it's also used within the grapevine itself. So the content is also reduced.
Does the vine itself produce malic acid as well? Is it like you're saying tartaric is fixed? Here we are. This is the amount Veraison occurs. This is our tartaric acid. Malic acid, it changes because it's consuming malic acid depending on the climate. But does the vine produce malic acid as well?
I don't think at that stage it does. I think, again, it's kind of at a point, but it can be degraded. I don't think it's you gain malic acid,
yeah,
when you're going through kind of post-Veraison ripening.
I tell you what, those grapes at Veraison must be absolute. I've never had one, but imagine they're absolutely disgusting.
Yeah, so we start maturity analysis really early. So sometimes it's the end of August and the grapes are really, they're not even through Veraison. They can be like peas, really frozen peas. They're really hard, which is a treat on the knuckles when you're trying to get the juice out. But we can have seriously high malic at that point, and you taste it and your whole mouth just feels furry. You know, it's that high acid that it's just really unpleasant and dry and drying and just not nice. So it's remarkable, actually, the sensory change that happens in those short few weeks from Veraison to ripening. You can understand why the birds don't want them when they're like that.
Yeah, I can imagine. All right then, Mary, I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much.
No worries. Thank you.